Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the Malou and Carlos Alvarez Theater in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is Cutting Through the Chaos, a special program hoping to hold the line against disinformation, produced in cooperation with Trinity University. Beware false knowledge. It's more dangerous than ignorance. Disinformation, if unchecked, leads to radicalization. Social media and even some old school media do little else but spread disinformation. Disinformation is worse than misinformation because disinformation is deliberately misleading with a manipulated, corrupted narrative with facts designed to mislead you or radicalize you. And right now, 2 weeks before what might be the most important election ever, disinformation is out of control. So how do we protect ourselves, our families, and our communities against the spread of these weaponized lies? Who is most vulnerable to the influence and seduction of disinformation, and does the truth matter? I interviewed historian Timothy Snyder recently, and he said, when we are post-truth, we are pre-fascism. So yes, truth matters. And with us tonight to discuss this important issue, we're joined by Althea Dulwich, professor in the Department of Communication at Trinity University. Althea, welcome to The Source. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Craig R. Scott, a senior faculty research associate at the Center for Media Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. And Craig Scott, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
And also with us is John Taylor, professor of political science and chair in the Department of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And John Taylor, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, Dave.
So, Althea, let me start off by asking you. So when we're talking about disinformation, and it seems to be all around us, but why does it matter? I mean, how does disinformation actually impact my daily life?
Well, disinformation, contemporary disinformation, is undermining the fabric of connections that knits us together with our neighbors and our communities. And much disinformation is intentionally designed to polarize us, to pit us against one another. So if you find yourself driving down the freeway and feeling that sort of uneasy feeling in the pit of your stomach, and you're trying to interpret the bumper stickers on somebody's car, figuring out how they might vote or what they might think about you, that's partly the result of disinformation. If you feel a sort of destabilization and uncertainty that familiar guideposts are no longer holding true, that is also quite intentionally the result of disinformation.
But so Craig Scott, I mean, in my daily life when I'm, you know, working, going to the grocery store, trying to pay my bills, trying to keep the wolf from the door, I mean, why should I be too concerned about disinformation?
Well, I think we saw recent examples maybe in not so everyday, but very real examples like with the hurricane and people not applying for benefits that they were eligible for. And so there are real consequences with that. But every day, I think we're not always aware, perhaps, that we're being disinformed, but that too has consequences. And when we don't, as Althea was saying, when we don't really have those same arbiters of truth that we've been able to turn to know what's fact, to know or maybe evaluate that information that we're receiving to know if it's true, I think there are all sorts of small consequences. It could have to do with our health and our well-being and who we trust as far as doctors. It has to do with the reviews we read about products and services, and can we, you know, are those legitimate or not? Do I trust those? And there are consequences that I think stem from issues like that.
But John Taylor, we're being told that disinformation is a direct assault on our democracy, and we are being lied to about, you know, policies that are being presented to us about what the future of the country will be like. And is that a real world example of how disinformation is actually impacting human life?
Oh, no question it is. I mean, think about Springfield, Ohio. They're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, they're eating the geese. We see AI fakes of Taylor Swift back in July, supposedly endorsing Donald Trump. It's everywhere, and it is a serious problem for democracy.
So, I don't care if they're eating cats and dogs. I mean, It's not here. I'm not eating the cats and dogs. No one, and my cat's fine. So what is going on there, Althea? Why is that, why is that disinformation?
Well, I think that things like eating the dogs, eating the cats are designed to leverage grievances and to provoke fear of the other. And it doesn't matter if it's true. It does matter if it's true, but as far as the purveyors are concerned, it really doesn't matter if it gets people to be afraid of immigration.
And so, Craig Scott, the fact that they are not eating the cats and the dogs and the pets in Springfield, Ohio, not the Haitians, no one is, and nowhere in the country is that happening. That's easily provable. This line that this was presented to us as fact, easily not fact. Why, why is that still being passed around? What's happening? Why does it still have currency?
It feels as though, at least one side of those sorts of claims has tried to argue that, well, reports said or people said, and we get these ambiguous kind of references to folks out there who are experts and know, and therefore that becomes justification for spreading what may be mistruths. And it's very difficult to argue against a unknown source, an unknown kind of purveyor of this, if we can't point to who said that, exactly who's kind of making those claims. And when that's not there, it's harder and harder to argue against those sorts of claims.
And but I saw pictures on the internet, John. it was a guy, he had a grill in the backyard and he was cooking something, and it could have been a cat or a dog or I don't know, a ferret or something. So, it was pretty convincing.
Well, I'm about as convinced as seeing Donald Trump in a Pittsburgh Steelers uniform last night, apparently. It was also tweeted out there. So, yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, I think he's playing loose end.
Apparently he was.
But what is he, so there is this attempt to fortify disinformation. And it seems to be growing, being done organically on the internet. There are people who want this to be true, so much so that they're willing to falsify information and put it out there.
We have a vice presidential candidate who essentially said as much, that it doesn't matter if it's true or not. We're trying to get a story across that's helping our campaign.
So, Althea, what is this crap test? It sounds terrible. And it's supposed to be helpful in trying to figure out what to do about and evaluate disinformation.
Certainly. So the CRAAP test was designed to help people who are trying to differentiate disinformation from the truth. And the letters, there's actually two A's. It's C-R-A-A-P.
That makes it fine.
Yeah, that makes it not a bad word. It stands for currency, relevance, authority, accuracy, and purpose. So currency is this current information. Often there's old information floating around out there or old images that have been repurposed. Is it relevant? Does it apply to the discussion at hand? Is it an authoritative source? And I think that's something many Americans struggle with, is determining what is an authoritative source. Is it accurate? And what is the purpose? Is it designed to outrage us, to offend us, to make us angry? Or is it designed to tell us the truth?
We're taking a break. We're going to continue our discussion talking about disinformation and cutting through the chaos. And we're going to take some questions from our audience members. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're talking about Cutting Through the Chaos. It's a special program that we're doing in cooperation with Trinity University as we discuss disinformation. Right now, as the election is just a couple of weeks away, we're kind of being hit with disinformation at like a fire hose. And this is something that is deliberately manufactured in order to influence your vote. But even after the election, this will likely continue. We saw it 4 years ago with the Stop the Steal movement, which led to January 6th. All sorts of deep fakes were coming your way and other your social media stream. How are you dealing with this wave of social media disinformation? And so let me ask our panelist, Craig Scott, Senior Faculty Research Associate at the Center for Media Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. Why is social media seem to be the vector that is the delivering disinformation like never before?
In some ways, I'm perhaps the least qualified person to answer that question because I've made some conscious choices not to be on a number of social media platforms because of some of what goes on there. But I in answer to that, I think there are certain qualities of social media that actually make them fairly addictive almost, to where we cannot turn away. A lot of the folks that are using these, you know, we figure out certain ways we get people hooked. And it's not a clinical addiction, but it's a different type of addiction that we know from some of the research characterizes the nature of some of these media. And that just creates an environment where disinformation is that much more likely to spread.
Althea, Trinity University, why do you think that social media, you know, Twitter, Facebook, some of these, Instagram, why is that where people are being exposed to disinformation?
I think there are two things. First of all, what we're seeing on social media is just this incredibly sophisticated computational propaganda that combines data mining that looks at what our habits are and our likes and our dislikes and our loves and our hates. It micro-targets us based on those things and then uses algorithms to control what we see. So our feed is not just a chronological feed, it's controlled by the algorithm. And the reason that we're being reached there is because many people have disconnected from traditional media.
We're hearing that there's a reward system, even incentivized. People are able to actually make money on Twitter and some of these platforms by being an influencer in spreading disinformation. So we have a system that's actually working against society, but rewarding the worst actors. John Taylor, can you?
I would not disagree with that at all. Given a particular multi-billionaire who owns a particular social media site, who seems very ensconced, very much enamored with a presidential candidate, and is doing everything possible to basically manipulate the algorithms to the point that if you're on Twitter, excuse me, X. If you're on Twitter, you see For You. And what's happening is, let's say that you happen to be progressive or liberal. You're not getting progressive and liberal feeds for you. You're getting all these very conservative feeds because that's what's been fed into the algorithm to put them at the top in terms of a prioritization. So it is influencing in that regard. To be honest, social media, I'm an avid Twitter user. We follow each other on Twitter. It was a great source for information in the days before Musk took over. And then he fired all the people that were in charge, basically of making sure that truth actually was followed and we actually went through accuracy. And now what we have is a situation where it's beyond the Wild West. It is. Twitter became 4chan is what happened.
I mean, most people don't even know what that, I mean, it's like, yeah,
that tells you how bad it is. 4chan is the website, and 8chan that passed along some of the most egregious, most evil, most vile false information and rumors out there. And now Twitter is acting the same way.
Theodore, which, how does this lead to radicalization of people?
Well, I think that one of the problems is people have disconnected from anything which could contradict the narrative. So it gets reinforced as the algorithm figures out what your preferences are. You fall down the proverbial rabbit hole, and that's what leads to radicalization. So somebody might start out by watching some videos that are perfectly legitimate about child trafficking, and, you know, 3 days later, they're a full-on QAnon believer who believes that there's a secret basement underneath Comet Pizza in Washington, D.C., and that Democrats are drinking, you know, adrenal fluid to prolong their lives by extracting it from children. And that happens through the reinforcement.
Right. And also, I've seen this, that they will have an algorithm will show certain minorities committing crimes. And that's you're seeing that over and over again. And so you are now made to believe that this is a type of person who fits that minority demographic, and they're more likely to commit crime because I've seen so many videos of that type of event. And so next thing you know, you're a bigot, you know, and it's, how do you, you know, and it seems like this was a system and a machine that was designed to create that type of you know, person who thinks that way. And it does seem like, how do we even respond to something like that, Althea?
I think that it really requires people to become aware of the power that algorithms have in determining what shows up in their news feeds. And I do see my students often doing this. Like, they're very aware of how to curate their TikTok feed or their Instagram feed. Sometimes,
how do they do that?
By choosing what they're going to watch and what they're not going to watch. Sometimes I'm assigning videos in class for YouTube, and students have a separate account just for the videos the teacher assigns, because they don't want to mess up their algorithm with the stuff that we're giving them.
All right, because next thing they'll be getting all sorts of really intellectual things.
I was going to say, sadly, Craig and I can't do that because we're at a state university and TikTok is banned in the state universities.
Right, so we have a question over here. Let's give a listen.
Hi, my name is Lizzie, and I want to go back a little bit to the crap test idea. I had a question about the last letter, the P, about, you know, the purpose of the information. What does it matter if like I watch something on Instagram and it's meant to be funny and it's real or not, and like I share it with my friends, but it's a funny story. Like, who cares if it's realistic? Who cares if it's true? How does the purpose, you know, influence truth or misinformation? If it's funny, does it matter?
Yes, it matters. It is funny, but the thing is, people believe it. You may be parsing it just as something that's funny without thinking about its truth claims, but other people may perceive it to be true. And if we live in a world where we're no longer trying to evaluate truth claims, then we're in a post-truth world, which, as David said, is like pre-fascism. Post-truth characterizes authoritarian societies like Germany in 1938 or Russia in 2024.
But, you know, a lot of the things that you see on these social media platforms are like prank videos and just people goofing around. And you look at them and you wonder, like, is this real? I mean, does this really happen? And you kind of realize, well, why were they even rolling a camera when this guy was walking down the mall and the thing fell on his head? You know, it doesn't make any sense, you know, that this would actually be recorded somehow. And that should be the first indicator. Well, this is probably fake, but it was funny. So, you know, I mean, the Brady Bunch was fake, I understand. So, you know, I mean, come on. Alice, a maid, how much money did they make at that house? So, you know, how do we tell the difference? It seems like, I mean, is it really that bad that we're breaking down those distinctions? You know, John Taylor?
I would say yes, because I'm thinking of videos that are much more vile in content, in which you have various racist social influencers, for want of a better term, who are putting out videos, usually it's within Twitter itself, and it's all about context. And you're seeing, for example, an assault. It's immigrants who are attacking, illegal immigrants who are attacking white kids in high schools, when it's nothing of the sort. And then that message is spread like wildfire among that particular subgroup in Twitter. And you end up with a situation where now all of a sudden it's become some form of truth. The truth is not the truth, but there we are. I mean, example, this one's more amusing, so we can bring it up for a minute here in terms of humor. This is from Blue Sky, which is one of the other social media networks. And it dealt with, again, the idea of disinformation, but kind of wink, wink, nod to it. It says, I'm a gay teacher in a blue state. When I get home from a long day of transing kids against their parents' will, there's nothing I like more than unwinding with a fun night of controlling the hurricane machine. And that speaks, though, to this idea of just how out of control some of this stuff has gotten and then the influence that it has on our politics.
So the hurricane machine is a reference to Congresswoman
Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's
she,
right.
She elected representative from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene, put out a tweet saying they can control the weather. I don't know who they is, and there is no controlling of the weather. So let me ask you, Craig, Scott, about the idea that she will put out there but they are controlling the weather. A person, a member of Congress, a distinguished individual of some sort of distinguishment, I don't know. But how do you, you know, what is she doing there? What is that action? I mean, is she really trying to convince people?
I think for most of us that understand how the weather works and how uncontrollable it is, you know, there's not a lot of impact to that other than just disbelief. And it's a repeated pattern of comments made by certain individuals. But if you are predisposed to already believe other things that that speaker says, there's a confirmation bias. There's a, well, if she said it and I believe other things, maybe there's some truth to this too. And so you're just that much less likely to reject it and might even believe it.
Well, let me ask it this way. If I'm a Republican and I really want to be a hardcore MAGA Republican, and then Marjorie Taylor Greene comes out and says they can control the weather, then it's not so much as you know, convincing me with an argument, but more likely she is informing me of what I need to believe in order to maintain my credentials as a person who is a full, you know, full-fledged MAGA. So it's not so much an argument, but it's like these, this is the script that you now have to follow. So
and there are certain keywords you'll hear, the deep state, for example. By the way, if Democrats controlled hurricane machines, Mar-a-Lago would cease to exist.
Yeah, and I would like, wouldn't you want to vote for the side that control exactly. the weather, you know?
Exactly right.
Yeah, we need some rain.
Thank you.
Yeah, they're trying to keep the rain from coming exactly. to South Texas, those guys. You know, so it's kind of like ridiculous, but, you know, it fits in with the Jewish space lasers yep. and other, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I think that there are many people who feel powerless in our society. They feel out of control, whether it's because of hurricanes or because of a pretty heartless economic system. And I think that's what the MAGA conspiracies have really played into, is this idea that there's some explanation, some sense of power that you can have by identifying the them, the they who's controlling things. It gives people a sense of where to focus their fear, and it gives them an explanation.
Well, so they want you to believe that weather machines are real, but climate change is a hoax.
Apparently.
Okay, so, and to me, that seems like the crux of it all. And so how do we, you know, there is no response to that type of, you know, dedication to this is what I have to believe, therefore, because it is locked into my identity and I'm too far in order to change now. And I'm just wondering, and we'll talk more about this when we come back from this upcoming break, but, you know, are these the people that we really need to be worrying about? It's an election. The people who are going to swing this election are going to be, you know, mainly housewives in the suburbs. They live in reality mainly, you know, because they're confronted with all sorts of deals that are, you know, hardcore real, like, you know, the price of eggs and milk and getting kids to school and property taxes and things like that. And the people who are believe that the weather machines and that climate change is a hoax, that's the lunatic fringe. You know, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that anymore or not, but that used to be an actual term that we used in politics. And these were the people that were part of the John Birch Society, which that wing, right wing, nut wing, a part of the right has taken over the Republican Party. So we'll see, you know, when we come back, you know, how does this actually impact people who aren't that deep into the Twitterverse? Anyways, we're going to take another break and we invite your questions. Raise your hand. Give me a comment. How do you interact with disinformation? Love to hear your comments. And we're going to take a 2-minute break, and this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a special program in cooperation with Trinity University. It's called Cutting Through the Chaos. We're looking at disinformation, how it impacts our lives and how it's impacting our politics and how it's impacting almost everything that we have in our life, including the economy. And so let me reintroduce our panel. Althea Delwich is a professor in the Department of Communications at Trinity University. Craig R. Scott, he is a senior faculty research associate at the Center for Media Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. And John Taylor is a professor of political science and the chair in the Department of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And we do have some questions from our live in-person audience. And so who do we hear from now?
Hi, I'm Angelina. And as a Trinity student, I am very excited for this collaboration. But my question, you know, the most vulnerable audiences for mis and disinformation are arguably those who don't have access to this kind of education and this awareness that it's actually happening. So how can that level of disinformation, misinformation be spread? What are things that we as people who are aware of it happening can do to help stop that spread of people who don't know what's going on?
All right. Well, thank you for that great question. Althea, let me ask you that first, and maybe we can hear from the rest of the panel. There seems to be a level of accessibility when it comes to like finding out the truth. Using the crap test requires time, requires energy, internet access, and also being able to get through some paywalls. So, I mean, how does that work?
How we reach those people?
Well, yeah, and is this like the system already, like we need to figure out like better access?
We need to figure out better access. People can't get past the paywalls. And I think we need to get outside of our own echo chambers, because often we're only talking to people like ourselves. And the people that the question was describing, we may not interact with on social media in our echo chambers. And I'm not quite sure how we connect with them, but I think we have to. I think that right now we're not even being allowed by the social media platforms to connect and have conversations with these folks.
And Craig Scott, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there are some examples. There's some of this work being done at our center up at UT Austin, but where we work with civil society organizations that can oftentimes connect with some of the more marginalized communities who, as you said, are oftentimes maybe kind of most impacted by some of this disinformation. And there are ways to make sure that we are kind of working with the leaders of those organizations to make sure we're dealing, if there are language issues, to where some disinformation is coming through, maybe in other languages, we've got to make sure we're
there's
there.
A lot of Spanish language disinformation that has been deliberately manufactured in order to create the red tilt that we're having in South Texas.
Yeah, and so being there through these organizations and other efforts to pre-bunk and debunk these sorts of things, I think can be really valuable and especially needed in those communities.
And John Taylor, so how do we break through that?
I'm not sure we can completely. That's the problem. Keep in mind, we'll just use Twitter/X again. Maybe about 20% of the American population actually uses that media platform. Many more people use Instagram and TikTok, and particularly younger people use TikTok. And so the question is, how do you go about eliminating or at least trying to mitigate disinformation? I'm not sure you can do it. As a political scientist, I'd say, we can pass legislation at the state and federal level. Yeah, good luck with that. Because the law never keeps up with technology. And the next big social media platform, whatever that may be in the future, and whoever's making the billions on that, is going to find ways to get beyond it as well.
Well, let me propose this. We can have a social sanction for people who believe in the worst disinformation. And laughter is a form of social sanction, and hold people in accountable and say, you're an idiot.
Here's the problem. And this is my problem, I guess, as a political scientist. I go onto the worst of the worst sites in Twitter. Going into the racist sites, I go into the QAnon sites. It is an entirely different world. And you read this stuff and you're like, how can you possibly believe this stuff? And you ask yourself, how can you actually encourage people to essentially come out what is almost like a cult-like following? And the answer is, you're going to have to do the same kind of deprogramming you do for people who are in cults.
Right. Okay. And so, Craig?
Well, I was just going to add, I think, for the most entrenched folks who are in some of these channels and communities, that it may be very difficult to reach them. But it probably won't help with others to do some of the name calling and the othering. And if we really want to potentially influence and change people's behavior, I think we know there are certain communication tactics that are likely to work better. We know there are certain kind of persuasion tactics where you don't kind of go completely opposite to someone's views, but you find kind of a zone of tolerance or acceptance where you can move people a little bit in a more accepting direction. And I just think there's greater chance of kind of dealing with this with the people who aren't firmly entrenched if we think about the tactics we use and we avoid some of the name calling that we're sometimes kind of prone to do.
So Althea, listen to people, make them feel at least seen and that they may have something wrong, but I understand why they may feel the way they feel, but maybe they need to just have someone listen to them a bit and then maybe bring them back towards the reality-based arguments.
Absolutely. Listen to them. Try to find common ground. Try to acknowledge what it is that's making them feel scared or feel like they have no control in their life.
Because people have misdirected anger. So they're mad because the economy is bad or they live in a part of the country where all the jobs were taken away. And then we have these streams that are there trying to exploit and manipulate them based on that anger. And they're really not are getting the facts. Is that it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you wanted to add to that, Craig?
Well, I would add, yeah, that sometimes we need to keep in mind that our goal isn't persuasion, but maybe it's understanding, right? There's some great information actually from a center in Johns College that I was able to access, a Center for Dialogue and Deliberation.
We're actually having a conference in 2 weeks.
Great. And it suggests there are ways to go about trying to understand and genuinely kind of try to empathetically listen to what others are saying, to ask curious questions, to try to withhold our desires to argue with people and to really listen and expect them to listen to you. And it's okay to disagree with people, but we don't destroy the relationships if this is someone we have a relationship with in that progress. So again, I think it's about how we go about talking with these others. And that's tough to do online,
right,
for sure.
And John Taylor.
This is where civic engagement comes in and the idea of getting people to actually, again, listen to each other. This is my problem being a professor in San Antonio is I'm on Dave's program or others, and then I run into people at HEB who they're like, I didn't like what you said. So then I'm standing in the frozen food section with them for 10 minutes talking about what I said on the source. And then we come to some sort of at least agreement or at least agree to disagree, and it's friendly. That's where we need to be again, and we are not there right now.
So, but I'm going to get to another question real quick, but I want to add this part here, that when you have individuals who are kind of really deep in the conspiracy sphere and QAnon and these ideas that they have, they tend to have this, adhere to this self-sealing truth that they have been convinced that the sources that they depend on are the actual real sources. And things like NPR, FBI, the Inspector General's reports, that's all fake and not to be believed. And they're willing to believe that even to the point where it even costs them money or puts them in jeopardy. It's like the only watch that will tell the right time is the Trump watch, that kind of a thing.
For as much as it costs.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, how do you like explain to somebody, if you can, that to consider, just consider, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but can you just think about the fact that, these things, these other sources are worth listening to, Althea?
Yeah, I think we can do that. I mean, I think we can make references to things like medical doctors that, you want a doctor who's trusting some authoritative sources and asking them, so what constitutes medical authority? I know that's a touchy subject in the wake of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's one of the real big issues of like, where do you get your medical information and attacks on that? We'll get to that. Let me go to a listener that we haven't been able to talk to. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Christy, and I'm approaching my question as an educator. So it's a little more focused on the youth. Some states, such as New Jersey, have passed laws to include media literacy in the state curriculum. So students learn about bias and database searching and strategies such as lateral reading. Do you foresee Texas ever requiring media literacy skills as part of the state curriculum? And do you believe that instruction of young people can help combat the flood of mis and disinformation online?
Okay, well, this would be Texas, and so that law would be coming through our legislature and being signed by Greg Abbott. So in their terms of, like, media literacy, it would be about how to read the Bible. But and that's actually being talked about.
It's being talked about.
So, you know, it may sound funny, but it's scary. So, Athea.
Yes, I mean, I agree that in Texas right now that would be a reach, but we desperately need it. And we see that there's a history of these approaches working. Between the First and the Second World War, the American public realized that they had been flooded with an immense amount of propaganda. There was a group created called the Institute for Propaganda Analysis that went to churches and community centers and schools, and they came up with a way of analyzing propaganda that boiled down to seven basic propaganda devices. Many of you may have encountered this in high school or college when you were younger. And it was extraordinarily effective in waking Americans up and teaching them the art of discussion and media literacy. So we know that it works, and we've seen many experiments since the 1970s using media literacy to educate people. It absolutely works.
Gotta take another break, and we'll be right back continuing our discussion about cutting through the chaos. What to do about the disinformation in our society. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're doing a special program, Cutting Through the Chaos. This is produced in cooperation with Trinity University, and we're talking about disinformation. You may have heard about there was COVID-19 disinformation that has definitely increased the disinformation sphere, anti-vaccine movements, the 2020 U.S. election fraud claims that continues to haunt our election system, QAnon conspiracy theories, that's still out there, misinformation, claims of a hoax at our mass shootings, all sorts of disinformation efforts that definitely is trying to derail a civilized society that we have. And we're going to get some questions from our audience, and so go ahead.
Hi, my name is Matthew, and I'm a substitute teacher. And one of the things I like to tell my students a lot is that you can reset your For You page on TikTok. They don't know that. You can reset your algorithm, which I think is really helpful for them. But I was just kind of wondering, you know, on a more informal way, you know, how can we put this media literacy into kind of everyday lessons and subjects? Like, do you think middle schoolers could handle learning about the crap test?
All right, thank you for that question. And you want to go ahead?
Well, Althea and I were talking at the break, and, you know, I think there's some real wisdom in doing this kind of earlier and earlier. I mean, it's unfortunate that we've had to have this kind of thing to reintroduce the need for media literacy. But it's true that we have to do it. And I don't think we can wait till college. I mean, we hear a lot of talk lately about the diploma divide. And, you know, we may not reach the folks who don't have a college education with some of this information if we wait until then to introduce it. So I think doing things in middle school and early on, whatever it is, makes a lot of sense.
I remember raising my daughter, we're watching TV together, and the commercials are on, and they have kids like eating cereal. I'm saying, that's an actor. Okay, that's an actor. That kid was paid to do that. He doesn't really like that cereal, you know. So, but I think younger generations are very much aware that someone is trying to manipulate them. And the reason why we call the TV programs is because they're trying to program you. And so let's go to our next audience member.
Hello, my name is Hersan. Is this mic working? I just had a question to you, David, and I guess the professors about the consolidation of media, because I guess over the last half a century, less and less newspapers are around, less and less TV stations do actual journalism. You spoke about Springfield, Ohio. I'm sure they used to have three or four newspapers, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. They probably only have one now, and less local journalism gets done, less and less people watch the news, and it just feels like, well, now it's just one guy owns Twitter. Rupert Murdoch owns Fox News. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. When you get all these people, and they're all pretty much from the same class, they don't really talk about the day-to-day problems of normal Americans, you know? Ohio, Springfield, Ohio, I'm not familiar with it, but Ohio used to have some of the richest cities in America, and Youngstown and Cleveland, just working regular jobs making steel or television sets, and those jobs are gone now. And if no one's really speaking to people like that, they're going to be sucked in by misinformation, by things that just don't make any sense. But their lives don't make any sense. They live in the richest country on Earth that the world's ever seen. And we've got income inequality levels worse than, like, the Pharaohs. So I guess there's a lot of problems in this country, and no one's really speaking to them. And I guess the problem is journalism doesn't really, the people who pay journalists or own the news that people listen to, Fox News, The Post, The New York Times, they don't speak about them. So I guess my question is, how does that happen? I mean, NPR doesn't, I mean, they're good, but they don't really get into a lot of people's radios, you know? How do you spread good journalism, you know? I guess that's my
right. Question. As far as the media consolidation goes, it's consolidating, but it's also fragmenting simultaneously, and that's also the part of the problem, that it's so hard to reach so many people all at once. And then it also opens up these channels where you do have the ability for a small number of people to manipulate, moderate what's going on in that channel. And these are usually, and they can be, bad actors. But John, you know, tell me what your thoughts.
Media concentration, think about it this way. I mean, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, we'll just use that. I just went across the board in terms of ideology. All three are paywalled in one of the most, if not the most important election in American history. When you could have access to that fully, it might actually make a little bit of a difference with readers, potentially. Then you look at how, and it's, I'm not going to blame a president, but I will blame a president, Reagan, back in the 80s, when you began to see the changes in media ownership, the changes in the way that the FTC and the FCC regulated media in general, and you began to see this concentration build and build, and then the Telecommunications Act of 1996 came along and encouraged it even further, where all of a sudden ESPN and ABC and Disney are all combined. Yeah, that's an issue and a problem. And as David said about fragmenting, yeah, that's also happening because people are banning it. And what are they banning it for? They're banning it for either social media or for other sources that are much less reputable, and therefore bringing back the whole idea that we can't trust the information.
So when I grew up, the New York Times was paywalled because I would have to fly to New York City to get a copy of the New York Times to read that day's version. Living in San Antonio in the 70s, you know, we would get a copy maybe a day or two late. And then, you know, there was the news with Walter Cronkite or Frank Reynolds or whoever on the evening news. It was just half an hour. And it was curated towards middle America. And so, and it's one like that. This disinformation system, you know, was leaflets and flyers and people screaming on the top of soapboxes in Alamo Plaza, you know. So, I mean, so is there a way to get back there, Athea? Is there a way to get to find the serve middle America?
I think there could be. I mean, I have believed from the beginning that one of the promises of new media, of digital media, is the way it decentralizes communication power. We saw that in the existence of things like zines. We see things like local small presses that serve, say, the East Side business community, for example. And so I think we do have tools that would allow us to create forms of local journalism that answer the needs of people in their communities and help to connect them in authentic ways. But we have to make sure people know that there's something happening called journalism in these publications that is actually following practices of journalism for determining truth and falsehood. And I think we can get there. The technology is there. We need some journalists to stand up and use it.
And bring back the Berkeley Barb. let's go to another question.
Hi there. My name is Sam. And this topic makes me think of a really stressful time coming up, which is Thanksgiving, especially with a politically split household around the dinner table. I was just wondering if you have any advice for attacking or kind of putting away misinformation around either close friends or family members and how you would go about doing that.
Instead of having a turkey, you should have one of those Haitian gooses. all right, so what do y'all have to say about that?
Oh, Lord, help me.
Surviving the holidays.
Surviving the holidays, my advice to you is to complain about Jerry Jones and his defense. There you go. Get away from any political topic.
Find commonality that we can agree
Thank
on.
Thank you. Yeah.
No, but, it's kind of like you're in our household, you know, don't bring these things up. Don't talk about them. And And sports is a great, you know, common topic. But, you know, eventually, you know, someone will bring up the fact that how liberal I am and, you know, how are things going at the commune.
Or how Jerry Jones donates tons of money to Donald Trump and then it sets itself off.
Right.
And then you've got, you go from there.
So, but when they hit you with the disinformation, when they tell you deliberately, you know, okay, you know they're only letting the migrants cross into the United States in order so that they can, the Democrats can take over the country.
Exactly.
It's an army. It's an invasion. You know, that is completely false. It's disinformation, one of the high points of disinformation warfare right now.
Sure.
And so you know, how do you just sit there and just nod and go, well, that's nice. And
I mean, other than have your third glass of wine, a variety of organizations on the left and the right actually create talking points for Thanksgiving dinner, for God's sakes. Just a thought.
Okay. And you want to, Althea?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, they're your family members. They love you and vice versa. And I do think that provides a starting point for a conversation, especially if you keep parameters around it. And you both know that these things tend to get heated. And so there's always that coming back to that fact that you love each other. And I think that's powerful. I think we need that more than ever right now.
And turn on the All in the Family marathon on one of the channels. Okay. Another comment from our audience.
Hey there. My name is Molly Barkus, and I'm sitting with six other Trinity University students. We all entered college at a crazy time with COVID, and then another formative part of our lives was during the 2016 election, and now a lot of us are entering the workforce. How do you stay hopeful with all of this disinformation and all of these, like, really evil things that we are just constantly bombarded with all of the time?
Well, I think about how the founding fathers really marketed a lot of disinformation, like the New York Post, founded by Alexander Hamilton, started out as a disinformation rag, and it continues that tradition today. And we can get out of this. We've been in worse places before, but yeah, correct.
I mean, I think it's helpful to remind ourselves that despite kind of what we see and how skewed some of social media makes the world seem, most people aren't jerks. I actually saw some recent data, research-based evidence suggesting that only about 3% of people online we would classify as toxic, even though they're spreading 33% of the kind of disinformation that's out there. And less than 1% of folks in this particular study actually are the ones who spread almost 80% of the disinformation. So we sometimes think things are a lot worse and everyone's messed up. I don't think that's true. I think there are reasons to be optimistic. I think your generation can be part of the solution in fixing some of the algorithms and dealing with some of this.
Sure.
And Althea, do you wanted to add anything to that? I mean, Twitter is not the world.
No,
so we have to realize that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. I think things are getting better. I agree. And I think that each generation that I've had the pleasure of working with as teacher seems to be more awake and aware and empathetic and inclusive than the previous generation. And things are getting better. They really are.
Right. So, you know, things will get better. We just have to get through the next couple of weeks and we'll see. Or else I will end up in the Laura Loomer concentration camp for re-education. You know, but it all depends on how people vote. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio, Cutting Through the Chaos, special program in cooperation with Trinity University. Thanks for listening.